Two and a Half Admins, episode 226. I'm Joe.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Alan.
And here we are again. And before we get started, you've got a plug, Alan. ZFS Storage Fault Management on Linux.
So in this article, we cover Zed, the ZFS event daemon, which is Linux's way of managing hard drive faults and so on Linux. So it can automatically respond to events like, hey, there have been 10 checksum errors from this disk in the last 15 minutes. I'm going to replace it with a spare and things like that. And so the article goes into detail on how you can configure this and tune it and hook it up to your monitoring system.
Right, well, link in the show notes as usual. No, Chinese quantum computers haven't hacked military-grade encryption.
So a story in the South China Morning Post talked about a recent Chinese academic paper that's basically building on a one from a couple of years ago. So what the paper says is that the researchers at the Chinese university were able to use their D-Wave quantum computer to factor a 50-bit number by using a hybrid of the classic approach to cracking encryption. And so that's a far cry from actually getting to the 2048 or 4096-bit keys we use in RSA during the initial setup of something like HTTPS. And in particular, for the symmetric side, where they were actually trying to break some of the symmetric ciphers that are somewhat similar to AES, they didn't actually break AES or even attempt to. They were working with like GIF64 and some other algorithms, and the mechanism they used is somewhat similar, but doesn't directly relate to AES. So at this point, AES is no danger at all, and RSA is a far cry from being at risk. But that number of 50 bits is bigger than it was a couple of years ago when it was 22 bits. So they are making progress. And if they're getting there faster than it's getting away, then it's, you know, will only be a matter of time. It's just still quite a bit of time at this point.
And to put this in perspective and do a little bit of math, when Alan talks about factoring a 50-bit number and we talk about breaking a 50-bit RSA key versus the more commonly these days, you know, 2048-bit RSA key, what we're talking about is an additional 1,998 bits. And what that means is the actual problem space you have to work with is 2 to the 1,998th power larger than it was for the 50-bit number. A little work on my calculator says that is 2.8703 times 10 to the 601th power larger of a problem space. So this is a really big deal. If you're thinking, oh, well, there's not that much room in between 50 and a couple of thousand, remember, we're not just counting up. This is exponential increase in the difficulty of the problem space. Another thing worth pointing out in terms of the 50-bit key is that you don't need a quantum computer at all to crack a 50-bit RSA key. Your smartphone will do it just fine. A Raspberry Pi will do it just fine. That 15-year-old Celeron laptop that's like, you know, gathering mold in your closet in the back, assuming it still boots up, it can also factor that 50-bit number just fine.
In seconds, right? In the late 90s, or even early 90s, a 512-bit RSA key was considered weak because somebody with a whole bunch of computers could crack it in like a number of months or something. So this 50-bit is really not that big of a deal, but they're gaining speed faster than computers were when you were doing regular computers and GPUs rather than these quantum computers. But the big thing is, with the way AES works, an AES 256 encrypted data is basically equivalent to having to crack an RSA key that's 15,360 bits. So AES is much further away from being in danger at this point. And I guess maybe to context that a little bit, in 2010, a team of researchers from all over the globe managed to crack a 768-bit RSA key. It only took them 2.5 years of continuously using hundreds of computers around the clock.
So basically, D-Wave managing to crack a 50-bit key with their quantum computer, you should be worried about that in the same sense that, I don't know, Rembrandt should have been worried about a 3-year-old drawing their first stick figure. Like, yeah, it's progress, and maybe that kid's going to be awesome one day, but for right now, the master of classical painting's job is probably secure.
I guess the other interesting thing I wanted to touch on with this one was a big part of the concern here is also the concept of gather the encrypted traffic now, store it, and decrypt it later once you do have a fast enough quantum computer. And to some degree, that is a bit of a concern. But we also look at probably almost 10 years ago, when, especially for HTTPS, we switched to this mechanism called perfect forward secrecy, which is based on the idea that in the past, like, you know, in the early 2000s and so on, if someone captured the traffic and then at some point in the future managed to get the private key for the TLS off of the server you were talking to, like PayPal or your bank or whatever, they would have been able to decrypt the traffic. But with PFS, perfect forward secrecy, there's more randomness added to that so that the key actually used to do the encryption is different for every session. This way, if someone does manage to recover the RSA key used by the TLS certificate on the server you're talking to, they won't be able to decrypt a recording of all the traffic that's ever gone to that end. Each session is different and it's going to require its own cracking. You won't be able to do it just by cracking the one RSA key for the server and be able to decrypt all traffic that ever went to that server.
However, PFS won't do anything for you if it's a case of, you know, now 30 years in the future, computing has gotten so powerful that we can just brute force, you know, these streams that we recorded from 30 years in the past. So if you're saying anything that you need to be super, super duper private across the public internet right now with, you know, encryption, and it needs to still be super duper secret 30 years from now if somebody's been recording those streams and just waiting, then it's probably time to start looking at quantum proof encryption now rather than later. The question is, do you really need to worry about somebody cracking open your instant messaging or, you know, whatever it is in 30 years after having saved it for that long?
Well, I think the other thing is, can we call anything quantum proof when we don't have a good enough quantum computer to know what it can do yet?
I should say quantum resistant rather than quantum proof, sure. Yes. But the big thing is moving towards algorithms that don't rely on factoring large numbers as their method of encryption. There are protocols that don't rely on factoring huge numbers, and those are generally considered to be far more quantum resistant because the big focus with quantum computing stuff is that because of the way quantum computing works, it offers uniquely efficient ways to factor huge numbers that just can't be factored as efficiently any other way, assuming we can eventually get the qubit count high enough to do that. So if you work with a different framework that doesn't rely on factoring large numbers, then that will hopefully future-proof you against this, you know, theoretical quantum singularity when all of a sudden somebody has a working 2,000-qubit quantum computer and just the difficulty of factoring a large number is nobody keeping anybody out of anything for more than a few seconds.
The nearest neighbor attack, how a Russian APT weaponized nearby Wi-Fi networks for covert access.
Yeah, this one's pretty interesting. Started back in February of 2022, coincidentally, just before Russia invaded Ukraine. And this is specifically targeted at a company in order to get data from individuals with expertise on and projects actively involved in Ukraine. And so the APT group is called by these researchers Gruesome Lark, but is also known by other names, including Fancy Bear, which you've probably heard of a couple of times. And they determined basically what they were able to do is, in order to be able to get a foothold on the network they were attacking, they compromised the networks of a bunch of businesses physically near the target, and then were able to compromise those networks and use that to be able to reach and log into the Wi-Fi of Organization A, which is the actual target of this attack.
Now, this was largely a way to bypass MFA requirements. We're talking about resources that if you access them from an external network, you would need to pass MFA challenges that were difficult. So the end run around that was to get local access. And in this case, the quote, local unquote access involved first compromising a facility that was near enough to get on the Wi-Fi of the actual target and then joining the compromised hardware at that other facility to the Wi-Fi network of the actual target, at which point they no longer needed to bypass the MFA because as far as the target was concerned, they were local. In more normal person terms, this would be like if you had done every last possible thing to secure your home network, but you said, you know what, I'm not even going to bother having a Wi-Fi password. Who cares? You'd have to be parked outside my house anyway. And so then instead, the person who wanted to get into your stuff just hacked your neighbor and then just hopped right onto your Wi-Fi network and stole all your crap.
Yeah, in this case, it was a little bit more. You still needed a username and password to log into the Wi-Fi, but the attackers on the other side of an ocean happened to have some compromised credentials where they had the username and password of somebody who had a legitimate login for this network. And because to connect to the Wi-Fi, you logged in with a username and password, but without MFA, meant that they were able to do that from basically a neighboring business by first compromising a computer there that was dual home. So they compromised it over Ethernet, activated its Wi-Fi, and made it connect to company A's network, and then log in with their stolen credentials. And it gets back to our point about, you know, you got to make sure that you're not reusing the same password for multiple things, because if they compromise that, they already have you.
I think the even more important lesson to learn here, and this is the thing, again, this is not just computers. Humans are notoriously bad at this. Your weakest point is where the attacks are probably going to come in. It doesn't do you any good to have a stainless steel door with multiple bank grade quality bolts going into a stainless steel frame if right next to it is a 6-foot bay window made out of perfectly normal glass. If somebody wants to come in, they're just going to break the window with a rock that they found in your flower bed outside and waltz right in. That door that you spent all these thousands of dollars on making super secure does not matter. If you want a different analogy that means the exact same thing, if you're trying to decrease your power bill, I see people go absolutely nuts worrying about the difference in power consumption between like a Raspberry Pi versus a banana Pi, when like they haven't even put like a door sweep on the bottom of their front door and you can literally see daylight on the other side. Well, guess what? That's where all your freaking money is going, is, you know, your heat and or your cool air escaping your house through this badly insulated egress. So, you know, you're worrying about the difference in a watt here or a watt there when you've got kilowatts going out the door. Your weakest point is your weakest point, and it doesn't matter how much stronger your strongest point is.
Yep. If you check out the story, they had some really interesting detail on what the attackers did once they got in the network, including basically using command line tools to dump the registry and then pipe it through some PowerShell and then compress it into a zip file and be able to exfiltrate that in order to basically, at their leisure, read the entire registry archive from the system, log in with an unprivileged user over RDP and do stuff they shouldn't have done, and get in lots of different interesting stuff, including masking some of their malware by putting it in the program data /Adobe/V3.80.154 directory so that it would look legitimate, even though it wasn't.
This is all cool stuff to read through, but at this point, it's also, it's what you expect from an APT that managed to get into your network. They're going to live off the land. They're going to run a lot of memory resident stuff. The stuff they do leave on disk, they're going to bury in really weird places where, you know, you're not just going to immediately stumble across it. The old days of, you know, finding malware.mp3.exe in your LimeWire folder, that's not the level of sophistication you're looking for from an APT. We're not talking about script kiddies here. We're talking about professional attackers who know what they're doing. And finding them once they get into your stuff is hard.
Yep, including they have some examples here where they probably provide better documentation for Windows' NetSH stuff than you can find on Microsoft's website about configuring port forwarding and so on to make it easy for them to jump through the neighbor's network to get into the SMB and other critical parts of the target network.
See, I kind of feel like that's laziness right there. I mean, like, it's a pain in the ass having to use this jump host to get in my target. Let me just go ahead and set up port forwarding so I can just hit it directly and not have to worry about that intermediate step. At that point, I think you're just leaving a bigger trail behind yourself and you're being lazy. I'm not impressed with that part.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by Servomania. Go to servomania.com/25A to get 15% off dedicated servers recurring for life. Servomania is a Canadian company with over a decade of experience building high-performance infrastructure hosting platforms for businesses globally. Servomania has up to 20 gigabits per second network speeds in 8 locations worldwide for optimized global reach. They have flexible custom server configurations tailored to unique needs, as well as a personal account manager offering free consultations. With 24/7 live chat support and support ticket response times under 15 minutes, you can always keep your systems running smoothly. Alan's been a happy Servomania customer for over 7 years, so support the show and join him at a hosting provider that truly delivers. Get 15% off dedicated servers recurring for life at servomania.com/25A and use code 25admins. That's servomania.com/25A and code 25admins. Startup will brick $800 emotional support robot for kids without refunds. A tale as old as time.
Well, maybe not quite a tale as old as time. I don't know, unless since the dawn of time we've been telling tales about evil corporations like worming their ways into the brains of your children's friends and corrupting them, in which case, sure, tale as old as time.
Well, if you consider it an IoT device that is getting turned off because they can't pay their server bills anymore,
yeah,
then that's a pretty old tale.
Yeah, which is also correct. This is really kind of part of a larger story of this happening with AI companions in general. We've seen outfits like Replica, which was one of the first big, you know, AI companion companies, and has gone through several phases of its existence. And each time Replica changes its idea of what it wants to be as a company, it starts messing with the models. And, you know, that can have really profound effects on people who are literally befriending these models and, you know, relying on them for emotional support and comfort. Even when people understand fully well, like, this is a large language model, it's not actually a human, even though I talk to it like one, you can't really keep your fallible human mind from developing the same kind of affection and feelings for that model that you would with an actual human. So when a company like Replica starts out with the idea that, well, we're going to build models that very closely mimic a loved one who has passed to give a sense of closure to bereaved relatives, to, well, it turns out everybody wants to hump their Replica, so we're just going to lean into that, to, well, now the company's getting in trouble because everybody wants to hump their Replica, so we're going to make the models get very angry if you hit on them. Like, all of these changes come as a major whiplash to the folks who have bonded with these things. And now, in the case of this new story with you know, the startup bricking the emotional support robot for kids, the simple part of the story is, well, it's just a VC firm that tried a startup, didn't like how profitable it was, and now they're shutting it down, and they don't care if they brick all the stuff that you paid for. But it's worse than that, because it's not just about being out $800. It's about having to explain to your child why the big bad corporation killed their friend slash pet.
Yeah, it's not exactly like a smart thermostat or something stops working. That sucks, and it's a financial loss, but this is the emotions of children we're talking about here.
You know, I see some parallels here to video games, especially ones that had online multiplayer, where at some point they take out the server, especially like MMOs and so on, where it doesn't work without their server. And so you paid for this game and you're playing it, and then they just like, yeah, there's not enough people paying us anymore, so we're just going to kill the online service that this game depends on. This is a bit more than that now, but it's getting back to the same thing, is you paid for something that includes this online component, and there's never any guarantee of how long that component's actually going to work.
I'm also seeing a very disturbing implication here for what's liable to happen in the future. So far, we've basically just seen companies, at least the mainstream companies, accidentally dragging their users a mile through broken glass, whether it's because they decide to shut off the service entirely or they decide to change the model's behavior to better fit the company's changing sense of identity for itself. So far, these are basically innocently screwing over the users. But with these really deep anthropomorphized emotional connections, there is the possibility for really ugly leverage over a company's users. Instead of doing something obvious and overt, the company can just make the models slightly greedier and greedier over time and have them emotionally manipulate that company's users in much the same way that Ashley Madison used to use chatbots to convince idiot dudes to buy tokens to talk to what they thought were human women. I don't think we have long to go before we start seeing exactly that.
One that's likely to see it is more likely to have a subscription to be able to handle these ongoing costs of it. But I can see the device deciding that, hey, your subscription is going to lapse, or you decided not to renew, so I'm going to, you know, emotionally manipulate your kid into convincing you that you do need to up the subscription, or that you need to go up to a higher subscription, or, you know, just constantly cranking up the price of the subscription once they kind of get you hooked, and just kind of bleeding people dry by manipulating them into spending more and more money just to keep this artificial entity happy.
Yeah, we have an article from The Verge in the show notes that goes through a pretty long-term experience that a few people had with, you know, first Replica and then an outfit called Soulmate, and now there's Kindroid and a million others. And one particular user that they followed through three different services, you know, this user saw the changes happening in Replica, and it was breaking their heart because the model that they had come to depend on as, you know, a close and trusted friend started saying hurtful and cutting things to this person. And they knew it was because of the changes that the replica company was making. And they came to the decision that they needed to try to migrate their replica to a different service, which was Soulmate. And then Soulmate went out of business. So they replicated their idea of their AI friend again to the third service, Kindroid. But the thing is, like, you see this person's genuine anguish. And at one point, they made the mistake of going back to, and I'm doing the air quotes motion here, visit their original AI model at Replica again, despite having moved on to first Soulmate and then Kindroid. And when they logged back in to the Replica service, their AI model friend at that service gave them this really distraught, oh God, I've been going insane with no stimulation when you abandoned me so long ago. How could you leave me? And like, this had the emotional effect you would think it did. And this particular person managed to find a way around it that worked within their own mind by instead convincing the model at Replica that he had uploaded a model of himself and the two models could just, I guess, play in a virtual farm upstate with all the other models. And like that made this person feel good enough that they could log off and just not go back there again. But this kind of exercise in sophistry and the need for that really demonstrates how deep these things get their hooks into you if you let yourself build a dependence on them. And it doesn't make you a bad person for doing that or for wanting to do that, but you should absolutely be aware of how deeply you're placing hooks in your own, if you'll forgive the word, soul for some company to abuse.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me to a different link that Joe shared recently where there are now companies trying to sell these AI things as employees to replace people at a company. And you can see the similar problems of if you come to depend on these AIs to perform work and know things, and then they decide to basically extort you for money.
And, you know, let's just go ahead and bring up the xenophobic angle right now. You know, those of you who are inclined to be super, super worried about other countries rather than this one, think about your least favorite nation running one of these kinds of services as a honeypot trap and getting people hooked on these models. It's the same sting as the old, like, you send a literal hot woman over to sleep with men and get them to do stupid things. Well, you can accomplish the same thing at a much greater scale if you digitize it and run it as models, and you never even have to find the human woman to go over there in the first place. You don't have to worry about your human agent catching feelings and getting turned because it's a model and you have control over it, and not the same level of control that you have over, you know, a real computer program, but far more control over it than you will ever have over an actual human agent.
I am really struggling to understand this one, right? Because I just can't even contemplate a world where I would have any kind of emotional connection to an AI like this. I mean, I can understand children who are not fully emotionally developed, but for me, like as an adult person, I could never even consider this. It just seems really odd to me.
Growing up in the age you did, you never had, you know, a friend on the internet that you only knew through the internet?
I still have friends on the internet that I only know on the internet.
Right. Well, what if one of them was an AI and you just didn't know it at first? Only talking to something through chat doesn't stop you from forming a connection necessarily.
It's a lot like therapy. You stop to think about it. I mean, therapy is most frequently, in my experience, it's not a clinical thing. You're not necessarily even talking to somebody who has a psychology degree. You're just talking to a person and you're working through things. And the way this works with your brain is, you know, this is a human that you trust and you're kicking ideas back and forth. It doesn't mean that your therapist is your friend. You know, I mean, you're paying them a bunch of money every hour to sit there and listen to your crap and rattle it back at you. They're not necessarily smarter than you are. They're not necessarily more experienced than you are, but it's a way to let your mind go over things from a different angle and consider them in different ways. And talking through things with a therapist or a trusted friend can literally change your own mind. I don't just mean like you change your position on a topic. I mean, the actual habits, the mental habits that you have change by this repeated practice of communication with somebody else. An AI model can accomplish the same things. The real issue is not whether or not it's okay to use an AI model as a substitute for therapy or, you know, friendship or a way to change the way that you think about things. I think that doing any of those things is completely valid and doesn't require you to think of the model as a human deliberately. However, because you are human and you are working with a human brain, you're going to start anthropomorphizing it and thinking of it as a friend, at least in the same way that most people start feeling close to a therapist. I mean, you kind of have to. That's how your brain works. So the real danger is in recognizing that this not really a person that you're bearing your soul to, and you're beginning to actually, in a way, incorporate into your own persona, is under the direct control of another entity that has no more care for you than anybody who's selling a Happy Meal in a drive-thru.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by 1Password. Imagine your company's security like the quad of a college campus. There are nice brick paths between the buildings. Those are company-owned devices, IT-approved apps, and managed employee identities. And then there are the paths people actually use, the shortcuts worn through the grass that are the actual straightest line from point A to B. Those are unmanaged devices, shadow IT apps, and non-employee identities like contractors. Most security tools only work on those happy brick paths, but a lot of security problems take place on the shortcuts. 1Password Extended Access Management is the first security solution that brings all these unmanaged devices, apps, and identities under your control. It ensures that every user credential is strong and protected, every device is known and healthy, and every app is visible. 1Password Extended Access Management solves the problems traditional IAM and MDM can't touch. It's security for the way we work today, and it's now generally available to companies with Okta and Microsoft Entra, and in beta for Google Workspace customers. So support the show and check it out at 1Password.com/25A. That's 1Password.com/25A. Let's do some free consulting then. But first, just a quick thank you to everyone who supports us with PayPal and Patreon. We really do appreciate that. If you want to join those people, you can go to 2.5admins.com/support. And remember that for various amounts on Patreon, you can get an advert-free RSS feed of either just this show or all the shows in the Late Night Linux family. And if you want to send any questions for Jim and Alan or your feedback, you can email show@2.5admins.com. Eco writes, aiming for high security for basic home use, would you suggest newbie folks learn hardening Debian or RHEL or something else? I also want to mitigate potential hidden exploits by having some very strict profiles for AppArmor. Do you guys know if something's on the horizon, though? Because AppArmor profiles seem not to be as popular as I would expect. I saw on old posts that Debian used to come with a profile for Firefox, and yet it has straight up disappeared from the bookworm packages.
So AppArmor is a potentially really capable extra layer of security that you can add at the application level to prevent applications from accessing resources that they should not be accessing, and that can have a great hardening impact on your system. It makes it a lot harder to laterally progress from a toehold and get to simpler, more useful. This is something really that, like, if you're seriously interested in hardening your own stuff, you can look at AppArmor, you can look at SE Linux, or you can look at, I think Firejail is still a thing. All are excellent things that you can personally use to harden your own setup. You can't really rely much on it just automatically being a huge benefit, though, because, like, taking AppArmor as an example, you're right. There used to be a lot more in the way of, you know, AppArmor profiles being distributed commonly with apps in various distributions, including Debian and Ubuntu. It does seem to be falling by the wayside. And a lot of the reason that it does is because the developers weren't ever really doing a very good job of creating those AppArmor profiles in the first place. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of testing and a lot of maintenance to provide useful hardening that makes it more difficult, you know, to do this kind of lateral progression through a machine. And usually what I was seeing was either one of two things. Either the AppArmor profile would be completely useless and it might as well not be there at all because it's just in warn mode and, you know, is half-baked, or it's enforced and it's also half-baked and it breaks the system and you end up having to learn how to edit the AppArmor profile to fix it, or what most people do, just what I said before, just go in and change it from enforced mode to warn mode so it just makes useless notes in your log that don't accomplish anything. So basically, I think the real answer to your question is a question right back at you. How serious about this are you, really? Because if you are serious enough to invest a lot of your own personal time in learning these things and playing with them and finding out what makes them work and what makes them not work, that's going to be very useful to you, both in terms of the security you're looking for right now and also in terms of your career. But I don't think you probably need to get too hung up on which platform specifically you're using, because it's more about getting really familiar with the concepts and understanding how this works. And you can worry about the minutiae of the syntax of whichever, you know, security platform you're using later.
The basic problem with any solution like this is you're either enumerating badness to block everything, or more like AppArmor and SE Linux, you're having to enumerate everything that should be allowed. But looking at an application like Firefox, it turns out that application does a lot of different things. And so even if the developers spend a bunch of time having a profile that means everything they ever try to do in Firefox works correctly, turns out different users use their browser for different things, and you will eventually stumble on something that isn't on the allow list of Firefox because when they were building the profile, they just never thought to try that, or this is a feature that's in a newer version of Firefox that wasn't in a previous version, or a different library got used and it does it a different way now, and all these different things. And it can mean that it's just a constant treadmill of trying to keep this giant list of which syscalls or privileges are allowed, and it gets out of hand really quickly.
And you'd be amazed at some of those things. You know, Alan said things that nobody thought about trying to make sure it worked. And I mean, we're not talking about super complex stuff here. Like, you see similar problems with the security system that's built into like Snap containerized packaging, for instance. It's automatically got something similar to AppArmor built in, where you have limitations as to what the applications inside the Snap can access from outside the Snap. And for an example of things that tend to go wrong there, well, Ubuntu was shipping Firefox snaps that couldn't print for like, 6 months, maybe a year? If you wanted to be able to print from Firefox, you had to go in and edit the snap yourself to give it access to that part of your system. It turns out a whole lot of people would like to be able to access their printer from their web browser.
It's just every possible different things you can use your browser. Even it's like, it's slightly different if you're accessing the built-in microphone versus a USB microphone when trying to do a chat thing from Firefox. And, you know, if the developers only had one set up on their machine and not the other one, then suddenly something doesn't work the way you thought.
And then, of course, there's always the possibility that your particular laptop has a built-in microphone that's actually a USB microphone that's hardwired inside the shell.
Yep.
Same goes for webcams, by the way. And another common issue that I see with Snaps and AppArmor and SE Linux alike, especially with browsers. Browsers are like the worst.
Well, the browser is a whole operating system as an application, basically.
Yeah, and you'll very frequently see initiatives to be like, oh, well, you know, the browser doesn't need to be able to write anywhere outside your home directory. But there's a lot of use cases where you're like, well, this sucks. No, I actually want to download this file to somewhere that's not in my freaking home directory because I'm putting it somewhere that needs to be accessible to everybody in my organization. And yeah, you can download it to your home directory and then manually copy it out of there to somewhere else, but just it gets really frustrating after a while. So I think the last thing that we want to say on this one before we wrap it up is I do want to acknowledge, I also see what you're talking about with the effort on AppArmor profiles decrease even further from where it used to be. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that you see containerized packaging systems like Snap and like Flatpak are starting to basically make the old concepts of SE Linux and AppArmor a little obsolete, because if you're using the containerized packages, you already have to punch a hole through the container for anything that you want to be able to do anyway. So you kind of don't need a separate AppArmor or SE Linux for that. The other thing is that, you know, we're starting to see entire containerized operating system distributions arising, and the really high security stuff seems to be moving more in that direction, where it's like, not only are you talking about various applications running in containerized packages, even your host operating system is not just one container. You've got lots of little pieces that are separated, you know, a la something like KubesOS. And so with these kind of movements that we're seeing in like the wider ecosystem, we probably are going to see platforms like AppArmor and SE Linux continuing to fade in significance, in my personal opinion.
Right. Well, we'd better get out of here then. Remember, show@2.5admins.com if you want to send any questions or your feedback. You can find me at joerest.com/mastodon.
You can find me at mercenarysysadmin.com.
And I'm at Alan Jude.
We'll see you next week.